it kind of makes sense why an outlaw club like the Hells Angels started in California, because California had always been the place of rebellion historically, right? This is where you went to get away, and it went against the norms.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, I think that, look, you know, you got these guys running around Southern California, and, you know, the guys in the north like to claim it started there, and the guys back east like to claim that started there. The outlaws, we talked about the outlaws a little bit. We didn't get way off into it, but, you know, they were originally a riding club, a Harley riding club. They weren't outlaws, and they made this transition over time. Did they make it before the Hells Angels or after the Hells Angels? You know, that's the controversy. Mm-hmm. But they were in the midst of, you know, organized crime. And, you know, yeah, they worked with organized crime. Like I mentioned earlier, Taco Bowman died in prison. You know, he went to prison for racketeering. And he also had an additional 10 years he was doing for ordering my murder. They came out to Ventura to murder me. And what's interesting is the law enforcement let them come. The feds followed them into town. They didn't arrest him until they left town. They just, for whatever reason, I don't know, they decided not to, you know, try to assassinate me.
Wow. And what year was this?
This was 1995 or nine, I don't know, in the late 90s.
Wow.
And the feds called the Ventura police, and a Ventura police officer I knew came and said, "Hey, I need to tell you this. We got a moral obligation. Mm-hmm. The outlaws were here, and they were here to kill you. And we found a map, you know, where your house was, a picture of you, a gun with a silencer, and whatnot." I mean, Taco got 10 years, and, you know, Taco called me after he got, I know she's over there. She wants me to tell you this story when I, how I reacted to that when I found out, but I'll get into that in a minute. But Taco, I'd beat that state racketeering case, 59 counts, and Taco was doing life in prison plus additional 10 years for ordering my murder, and he called me from prison, and he wanted my daughter to help his lawyer with his appeal. And I was thinking to myself,
that's balls.
That's what I was thinking, the balls on this guy. So him and I talked, and I said, okay, I said, I'll have my daughter call Henry Gonzalez was his high-power Florida lawyer. And I said, well, I got to ask you a question before you get off the phone, Taco. I go, are you going to do the life sentence first or the 10 years you owe me? he told me to go to hell. And that was actually the last time I talked to him. He died in 2019 when I was in Spain.
He didn't make it out?
He didn't make it out. He tried to get a compassionate leave. He was dying of cancer. But, you know,
did he ever apologize to you?
He just said it was just strictly business. That's
the closest you're going to get.
Yeah, it was an apology, and I understood that, you know. And I said, you know, Taco, I said, I'll help you. I said, I don't want you in prison because you got a problem with me, you know.
Why did they come, if you're supposed to be like the clean charter president, right? Why would they come try to hit you? Why wouldn't they try to hit Sonny or somebody that was actually...
If you look this up online, it's Harry Taco Bowman versus the United States versus Harry Taco Bowman or Joseph Bowman or something. But it's, you know, it came down to two people, either myself or Sonny. And they may have decided to take me out because I was more, maybe more effective and had more power. I was wielding more power at the time. And they used to, haven't talked about this much, they used to call Sonny the Queen. And the reason they called him the Queen was because they said he now had no power. He was like the royal family in England, you know. He had a title, but he had no power. So they would call him, you know, should we get a hold of George or should we get a hold of the Queen? Mm. You know, and that's this. Right. I was told this by the outlaws after I left the club. One of the guys thought it was funny. He thought I should know.
What was that beef originally about? How did that start?
Well, Sandy Alexander and who's a New York Hell's Angel leader, and Grease Lightning, who was now an outlaw, had both been in the Alien Nomads together when Sandy decided to become a Hell's Angel charter on 3rd Street in New York. For whatever reason, Grease Lightning, you know, drifted off. He became an outlaw. They were still friends. There was no problems between the clubs. Grease Lightning came to town, to New York, to visit Sandy. Sandy wasn't there. The story is, according to Colette, Sandy's wife, I talked to her about it. I talked to Sandy about it as well. Talked to Colette about it probably as recently as 2 or 3 years ago. She just passed away. But Grease Lightning raped her. And she invited Grease Lightning up into the apartment, and he raped her. And Colette told Sandy. Sandy was a professional boxer. Sandy just beat the hell out of him. Obviously. Grease Lightning, of course. You know, he's lucky he didn't kill him.
Right.
You know, Grease Lightning goes back and tells everybody he got jumped by the whole charter. So there was a Hell's Angel in Florida that was selling drugs, ex-Hell's Angel. He still had a Hell's Angel patch, tattoo patch. And they went down there to get the tattoo covered. They went down there, they found the guy, got the tattoo covered.
Forcibly.
I'm sure they did. I didn't give them any choice, you know. I don't know if it was forced or not, but, you know, the intent was there.
Right.
So the outlaws get wind that the Hell's Angels are down there. So these two Hell's Angels call back and say, we're going over to the Outlaw Clubhouse. Sandy says, don't go over there, man. I just got in a fight with Grease Lightning. The energy's not in our favor, man. Don't go over there. They went over there, and I don't know what transpired. They took him to a rock quarry, shot them both in the back of the head with a shotgun.
The Hell's Angels guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So our guys kept calling the outlaws saying, hey, where are these guys? I don't know. They left here, man. And eventually, and this is kind of interesting, it's kind of part of the Hell's Angel myth and folklore. The member whose nickname was Riverboat floated to the surface. And
the irony.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had those pictures in the clubhouse, the autopsy pictures from them pulling them right. Well, they weren't autopsy pictures because they were pulled right out of the quarry. And these guys had it's terrible looking pictures, man. You can imagine getting shot in the head with a shotgun.
Of course.
And then being thrown in a river, a rock quarry.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's how the war started.
So now it's on.
So it's on, and it's been on.
But you don't know originally that this all started from one of your own.
Well,
raping
everybody knows. You know, okay. Everybody knows what the original beef was.
But I guess to kill two people like that so brutally is inexcusable.
No, yeah, it really escalated.
So then how do you, supposed to be the one keeping the peace, supposed to try to keep the club at least appearance-wise legal, how do you, what's your move there?
You've got me coming back from prison. That started in 74, maybe 73. I can't remember the exact dates. It's now 1988, 89. I come back to the club and I'm telling everybody about, did you know we don't fight with people in prison? You know, a lot of the guys don't know.
You know?
They think you go to prison. Like when I went to prison, first thing I asked it was a Hell's Angel leader down there. The guy that killed the two Mongols on the freeway, Redbeard and Jingles. I said, so who are we fighting in here? And he laughed. He goes, we don't fight anybody in jail. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, we don't fight in jail. You know, it was a moratorium on the violence. I said, well, why don't we do it on the street? You know? And, you know, guy's typical answer to me was, you think too much, man.
Yeah, right.
You know? And so I come home and I think, how am I going to sell this to people? And so I come up with this thought, start asking people, do you know why we're fighting the outlaws? Nobody knew why we were fighting. It had
Yeah.
You know, it had been put to rest years ago.
Right.
We were just fighting. You know, we hate these guys because we hate them. You know, it's tradition. And that was how I sold it to the Hells Angels. And, you know, I had gone to a bike show at Terre Haute Prison, and Taco Bowman was about 4 or 5 miles away from the prison in a hotel. And I went to the hotel unannounced. And he was just like flipped out. You know, he couldn't believe I went there with my patch on. And I said, hey, I just spent the day with, you know, a bunch of outlaws in the prison. It was a prison bike show. And I said, come on, man, when are we going to put this behind us? Mm-hmm. I go, people don't even know why we're fighting.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's pretty sensible and reasonable. And we opened a dialogue of trying to put the war behind us. And when I did find out that they had put that hit on me, I went to Chicago. The meeting wound up. I flew into Chicago, but the meeting wound up, I think, right on the border. It was in Indiana somewhere.
Gary?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Was it a shithole? Because then it would be Gary.
Yeah,
maybe. One that literally smells like wastewater treatment and is one of the worst crime rates in the
really? Well, I wasn't in the best of moods. I just found out that they had, you know, in the middle of these peace talks, they were going to assassinate me. So I went to the meeting. There was Hells Angels there and Outlaws there. And I just went in the meeting, and I stood up and I said, look, I don't know what's going to transpire here today. I said, I know about the hit. The law enforcement came and told me. I said, I heard about it through the banditos as well. And I said, this is a little advice for everybody. I go, whatever is decided upon in this room today, I will adhere to. I said, but there's one caveat. I go, if any of you guys, outlaws, ever come to Ventura unannounced, I'm going to assume you're coming to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes my family. So I tell you what I'm going to do. I am going to come back out here. I'm going to hunt you guys down. I'm going to kill you, your wife, your kids, your dog, your cat. And on the way out, I'm going to overfeed your fish. So don't fuck with me, you know?
Did you say that?
I did say that.
That's a good line. Did it get a laugh?
Yeah, I got a laugh, but it also kind of got uncomfortable.
Right.
And I said, now I'm going to excuse myself. And I said, if someone would let me know what's accomplished here today, I appreciate it. I'm going home. And I flew home.
Wow. Yeah. And so, and then did you presumably think that it was over?
Well, they knew better to come back to Ventura.
Right.
And that's all I had gone there to accomplish.
I wonder why the hit, did you ever figure out why it never went down? Why they never tried anything? Found out.
I think maybe because one of the guys was working for the government and he talked the guys out of it, because one of the guys wound up ratting on Taco. And
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
He that's how he got.
That's how they got him. You know, he said, you know, so, you know, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
You know, it.
A lot of informants.
Yeah, a lot of informants. It was a tough end for Taco.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, dying in prison. I mean, they wouldn't even give him a compassionate leave. Now, I don't know if it's true. I'm told in the federal system, even when you leave the prison in a casket or a body bag or however you leave, they handcuff you.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, I don't know if that's monsters. True.
That's, I kind of doubt it.
That's been the
lore.
The lore, you know, the prison lore.
Right. But maybe just to make sure that you're not faking your death.
Yeah, and then when you get to the mortuary, then they handcuff you and you're in the mortuary, people take over. I don't know, you know.
That's I wonder why that hasn't been attempted. That's a really good idea, you know?
Unless you're a criminal.
All right. Yeah. Criminal minded. Sometimes I think, you know, that's where my brain goes.
Do you try to think how you can beat the system sometimes?
Of course. Yeah. Especially when I was sitting in prison. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I almost wanted to get out and do crime again just so I could get arrested so I could beat it. Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I hear you.
Well, you've beaten it. Okay. So this is what we didn't talk about. We talked like the major case. I believe this is when you were sitting on Terminal Island.
Right.
This was when
86 and 87.
Was that when you were approached to do the hit?
Yes, I was.
Overlay. It was like $500 or something.
$1,000.
Like yeah, it was.
But the informant even stole $500 from the feds. He only gave him $500.
Right.
But that one money wasn't mine. That money was from my co-defendant, Danny Fabricant. I just delivered it because Danny had turned himself into jail.
Right.
But
can you explain that whole situation, that case, and how?
But it's very complicated. This gentleman named Mike Mulhern, who was a one of the ground floor guys in the Liam Mexican Mafia, came to me and said, one of your members owes us $10,000. I said, who? You know? And it was this guy that had been dropping the Hells Angels Ventura name.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't surprised when he said that. And I said, that guy's not a Ventura Hells Angels. He's got nothing to do with this. And he goes, well, he owes us 10 grand. And if you guys don't pay it, we're going to kill him. And I told him, I go ahead and kill him. You know, I'm not paying you $10,000
right.
to not kill a guy.
Right.
And that was the basis of the case, that I had
sanctioned
the murder. Yeah. And
it was like a throwaway line. It was like how you'd say, I don't care if you kill him.
Well,
like,
I said, if he was here, I'd do it myself. I mean, it was a very cavalier thing to say,
right.
But you know,
and he was wearing a wire the whole time.
Yes. And when I got in front of the jury, you know, I took the stand in my own defense up there 6 days. It was grueling, man.
Oh my God.
And I told the jury, I looked at the jury and I said, how many times have you lost your temper, got exasperated with your own child?
He
said, I'll kill him when I get my hands on him. And I said, that's the point I was with Tom Chaney. I said, Tom Chaney caused the Hells Angels in Ventura a lot of trouble. He was a drug dealer. He was a pimp. And I just didn't have any use for him. And, I said, was I break the law? I said, I didn't feel I broke a legal law. I said, perhaps a law of morality because I didn't alert law enforcement that they were going to make a move on this guy.
Was that the only evidence they had? Was that conversation?
Yes.
And didn't he put money on the table or something? I read on your Wikipedia page. Well, it was very strange.
He pretended to be dead. They actually staged the murder in Arizona prison. And,
of this guy, Tom.
Yeah, Tom Chaney. Yeah, they wheeled him out of the prison, put him in an ambulance, locked the yard down, and everybody thought he was dead. And, you know, they tried to engage me in a conversation about it afterwards. I wouldn't talk about it because I didn't care, but I still got arrested. And it was a long year.
So you took the stand. This is very rare in criminal cases that the defendant actually takes the stand.
The Hell's Angel leader takes the stand.
But usually, and we had a guy on here a few episodes ago, he was working undercover in the Bonanno family from New York. He too got almost like entrapped on a conspiracy to commit murder from just, again, something he said that was like, again, like a throwaway line,
right, you know,
that was like a cliche.
Okay.
And he took the stand. By the way, this is a guy that's worked for the FBI for years, and now they're putting him on trial for murder.
And why would they do that?
Because they're just monsters.
Okay.
They
don't, all right. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. They don't.
They don't care. They don't have any scruples.
No, it's very, very extremely unscrupulous. So, but he gets up there and they believe him and he beat the case. So I think, just by the nature of a defendant taking the stand in his own defense, that's saying right there, like, shit, I think this motherfucker didn't do it. This guy's not guilty. So just in that in itself really speaks to the innocence of a person, in my opinion.
Right, right.
They said you were very charismatic up there.
Yeah, I did a pretty good job. My lawyer was really happy. Do you know who Barry Tarlow was?
No.
He passed away. Just like incredible lawyer.
But how much did that cost you, though?
$500,000 in 1987.
I mean, it's just like it's
$500,000.
It's like 1.5 now. Yeah. It's like 1.5 million today or something like that.
This is the thing. If I hadn't paid it, I would have went to prison.
Yeah.
Because he knew how to beat that case.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned Alan Kaplan earlier. Alan Kaplan and Norm Green, who did the Stardust case.
Yeah.
they didn't know how to fight that case. They listened to the tapes and they were like, mm-hmm. man, I don't know how we're going to go about this. Barry Tarlow listens to the tapes one time and he goes, oh, I can beat this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, you can? He goes, yeah. I go, how much do you want?
yeah.
You know? And, wow. I mean, that's a lot of dough back then.
Holy shit.
That is and huge... you know what's interesting is my lovely wife, Beverly, was a character witness for me.
No shit. Yeah. It was not your wife back then.
No, she was not my wife. And... she was married to a good friend of mine. And they...
That is so old school. Somebody else was on here. Brian, yeah. Who else was on here that did that was friends with their current wife? You know what I'm talking about? Like knew his wife from years ago when she was married to his friend, and then his friend died. Sal Polisi. Yeah. Not Sal.
I got to take care of Beverly, man.
But that's an old school thing. I would want a buddy to do that for me. I would not.
Everyone says my husband would want.
Except for Brian. Yeah. No. At your age, I wouldn't mind because I can't imagine there's a ton of sex going on at 80.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Oh,
Jesus. I shouldn't have opened
this. No, you open that door up now. We're going to talk about it, man.
Travel the world with him. We wouldn't have to have sex if that was. And I go, then I don't fucking want to go.
This is the problem with women is they never want to stop having sex.
No.
But anyways, that's just funny that she was a character witness.
She was a character witness. And I'll tell you what the feds did. They froze her bank account.
I had an
invention. What?
A store. Marshals came in and froze my business because I was trying to test.
The U.S. Marshals came in and yeah, they just had the power effort to do that?
Yeah.
The bank was blown away.
So were you able to sue or no. Is there any kind of recourse?
You know what Barry Jarrett told me? He said, you're wasting your time.
Yeah.
He goes, you're leader of the Hell's Angels, man.
Right.
That's what he told me. He goes, you're leader of the Hell's Angels. He goes, you're wasting your time.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's the price you pay for being.
And you know,
the head of the
I've
Hell's
had
Angels.
People ask me before. You know, I was just happy to be free.
Sure,
I really was. You know, I was happy to be free. I my street cred was like the top of its game, man. Right. I beat the United States government.
It's like winning
the
lottery.
Yeah, I came back to the club. I mean, I was like. I was a West Coast chairman when I left.
Yeah.
And when I came back, I can remember it to this day. You know, the meeting took place at the San Francisco clubhouse. Usually it was Oakland or San Francisco. Uh-huh. And it took place at the San Francisco clubhouse. And when I walked into the room, all the presidents were in there. And they all stood up and clapped.
Uh-huh.
And one of the guys led me. I said, look, man, and they said, come on, man. You know, we want to lead me to the chair, my chair, my gavel and stuff. And I said, look, I've been gone a year, man. And they go, no, man, you're a leader, you know. And I was I mean, I can, pretty chilling. And, I was just like really emotional. I sat down and they were going, come on, speech, man, speech. You know, what was it like? You know, I stood up and I gave a little expo of, you know, the trial and what transpired. Apologized for having to spend all that money because the club paid for it.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Okay. So interesting. Let's talk about that. So I know that there's like a Hell's Angel bail system.
They passed the hat. And they taxed everybody in the United States.
Wow.
Some people from overseas sent money over.
Wow. Okay.
And it's really, this is a great story. Kenny Owens. We asked Kenny Owens for $10,000.
And, who's he?
Kenny Owens was a crank cooker.
Right. Okay.
You mentioned in Oakland.
From Oakland.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I come home and... you know, probably within 18 months, Kenny Owens busted $3 million in his wall and 30 pounds of crank.
Holy shit.
You know?
Yeah.
And so this is the mentality of the Hells Angels and being an outlaw. So Kenny Owens comes home. It's now 26 years later from his 40-year sentence. He gets out. And I go up and see him, and He just laughs. He goes, about that $10,000, George. Because, you know, he said he didn't have any dough, but he had $3 million. And it was behind a wall. You know, he had a
you know. But didn't they bust that, though?
They took it all. Yeah. They took his 30 pounds of crank and his $3 million and gave him 40 years.
It does kind of, that's why I kind of think, I mean, I can't, obviously, I'm not asking you to speak for other chapters internationally or whatever.
I can't, you know.
But it seems like if it's a pretty common practice when a brother gets locked up and is fighting a big case, that's expensive. It seems like they want people, they want members that are earners. So whether implicitly or explicitly, they turn the other way because crank money pays for the lawyer to beat the Fed case. But
look, this is an interesting. In order for the club to finance your legal fees, it has to be brought up and approved, and it can't be drug related. Now, that's the way it used to be. Like, you know, I don't know what it is now. Oh. You know. It
so if you get caught dealing drugs, you're on your own.
You're on your own. Yeah, that's pretty much the mantra.
Are there rules? Are there rules for the whole organization? Well, and then, like, how does that work? Are there actually written rules? And then you guys have sub rules per your chapter? I didn't ask you that earlier.
Well, you know, it's pretty basic rules, but you know, we talked. I was going to tell you a story, and I didn't tell you about Mike Wallace. You know, we talked about Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes, and so I go on the show, and Cisco Valderrama, Oakland president, goes on the show, and I tried to talk Cisco out of doing it because I didn't know if he was going to be able to handle Mike Wallace,
right?
And he didn't. He didn't do well. And you know, Cisco wouldn't talk to me for 6 months. You know, I went to Cisco and I go, you know, Cisco, I go, I've been pretty lucky with all the interviews I've done.
Yeah.
And I said, but it's not as easy as it looks. And I was trying to be gentle. You know, I don't want to hurt his ego. And he goes, hey, you know what, man? Fuck Mike Wallace. And I go, okay, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he went on the show. Mike Wallace destroyed him.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I'm going to tell you three things about Mike Wallace. He kind of apologized to Cisco for making him look bad, but, you know, that was the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
He had the hots for my wife, Cheryl, and he interviewed her and did a 60-minute interview and sent it to her for Christmas, had it edited. And the whole thing, it was just
so bizarre.
So I'm in the bathroom. I'm in the bathroom snorting coke. And Mike Wallace and the producer come in. And they're washing their hands. And I just taking a leak out there or whatever. So I pull my feet up off the toilet so they, you know, they can't see me. And so Mike Wallace and the this other guy, I can't think of his name. I think his first name was Tony. Tony says, well, what do you think, Mike? And Mike Wallace goes, I'll tell you what I think. He goes, I think they're all full of shit. But he goes, I like the Hells Angels a lot better than the Feds. That's an honest to God true story.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was just really, really funny.
Oh, and that's hilarious. Yeah.
Because I think they're all full of shit, but I like the Hells Angels a lot better than the Feds.
So what about the rules though? I was just asking you, it's not a deep question. I'm just curious about the organization.
Well, there's basic rules, you know, but
is that outlined like the way.
They're universal rules, but it doesn't have anything to do with illegal activities because these rules are.
But that's a pretty specific rule though. We're going to pass the hat for a legal fund unless it's a drug pinch.
Right.
So is that a organization-wide
I don't
rule?
Think that's a written rule, but I think that's a rule that, you know, takes place.
Implicit.
But I think that, you know, it's, I haven't read of many Hells Angels getting busted for narcotics. Have you recently?
Maybe not recently, yeah. but they're super known. Fair, they're super known for Crank.
Well, that's they said that, you know, Mike Wallace said, you know, you guys control the meth market in the United States.
Yeah.
And, but I'll tell you, who do you think controls the meth market in the United States?
Now, the Mexican cartels.
Okay, there
but
you
this
go.
Is and I want to tell you,
back in the late 80s, I was approached by someone, and this is after everybody got busted up north, and I was approached by these guys representing the cartels, and they said, we don't want any problem with you guys, and we're no offense to you guys, but we're going to get in the meth business.
Yeah.
And you guys already have the perfect distribution network.
Yeah.
What do you want to do? Let's do business together. Yeah. And I stepped away.
You said no thanks.
I didn't want anything to do with the cartels. Yeah. I knew about the cartels and how brutal they could be.
And they're still very active in Ventura. There's a lot of meth use, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, you read about a lot of, you know, Mexican guys getting busted in that area.
Sure. Yeah.
But you just didn't have anything to do with it.
I just didn't want anything to do with it.
And you could speak for good authority that there was never any Hells Angels meth dealing.
Not around there. I mean, meth use.
Yeah.
Very popular drug in the bike culture, but, you know, nobody was slinging it. I mean, the Mexicans were all slinging it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that you see the little power struggles. I had a good friend that I don't believe he was, you know, part of the interesting thing with La M is those guys don't really admit to being, you know, they get classified in that gang, if you want to call it that, prison gang. But they deny it, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not in the gang, you know.
Yeah.
But I know up in Ventura, right after that conversation a few years later, I know a, you know, Emmy associate, you know, he got shot and a bunch of money was stuffed in his mouth. You know,
whoa.
I think he had been robbing somebody or
wow.
it was some sort of power struggle. But, you know, and this is the interesting thing. The last phone number on his phone, the dead guy,
mm-hmm.
was me. He had called me about my bail. I had a bail bonds company.
Yeah. Wow.
He was trying to get a bail. So, of course, the Oxnard police ran with that. And they said, well, you know, he's right in the middle of this whole thing still.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
whoa.
But
what year was that?
Mid-90s, I'm going to say.
Okay.
Late
That's
90s.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, your bail bonds, did you bail out
Bailed out
members?
People. I bailed out anybody that called.
Yeah, but did you have to bail out your own members?
Yeah, sure, of course.
What did people take pinches for in those years?
You know, you want to know what one of the biggest problems was 11-550 under the influence of meth and driving on a suspended license. You know, I mean, that was the...
It's like college almost.
That was the big deals, you know. And, you know, people weren't, you know, waiting for the big drug bust. It wasn't happening. But, you know, what's interesting is this is how people spin stuff. So I have the bail bonds business.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody dies on a train track. Now, I don't know if he was placed there. I don't know if he
committed suicide
or if he passed out on the, you know, we don't know, but he owed my bail bonds company money. So that was the rumor.
Right.
You don't pay Christie, he throws you on the train tracks.
That's kind of good for you though.
Well, yeah, I guess.
It's not a bad to have that reputation.
It's not bad to have that reputation, but it cuts both ways.
Yeah.
I also, a lawyer was killed on the train tracks. Now, I don't know if he was aimlessly wandering or whatever. And
nobody just falls on train tracks.
Right.
It just doesn't happen.
That was another thing. They say, well, he didn't all bail, but he's a lawyer and he's in the legal. He must have crossed Christie somehow.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you get that reputation and you carry it with you. And I, you know, it's funny, you know, Beverly and I walk a lot and, you know, we run into people and some people, you know, everybody's real friendly to Beverly and I talk to people. I enjoy talking to people, but, you know, I'm kind of cautious because people recognize me sometimes and then they get all weird. And so I still have that, you know, that reputation.
Yeah.
A woman we'd talked to for months, and then she finally figured out who I was. And, you know, her response was, "Oh, you're that bad guy."
Right.
You know who I'm talking about, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, was
lying.
Huh?
Judges walk up to us every day.
Oh.
Cops.
Yeah.
The judge goes, "No hard feelings, George."
Yeah, that's a true story.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cops everywhere.
Yeah. You're just a figure. You're a figurehead in the community.
Yes. You know, I mean, I'm getting a little older now. A lot of these younger people don't, you know, they don't have any idea who in the hell I am.
Yeah.
And, but
wow, that's something.
It is what it is.
You know? That's something. Yeah. It's good and bad because it's,
You know, just
fame. Fame. There's,
I just did a show on A&E, you know, and, you know, it ran 8 episodes. I was in all 8 episodes, not featured a lot, but been prominent in each episode. And, you know, you go to a restaurant and you get recognized.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was, you know.
Yeah.
It's just funny. You know?
Is it a good feeling?
Like, and I, you know, I like it. I don't, I think I wear it okay. You know, I never let it go to my head.
Yeah.
And it's, now people are going to go, yeah, listen to this guy. But, you know, been well known for a long time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you learn how to deal with it properly or you turn into an asshole.
Sure.
And I, you know, I see a lot of guys in the club, they get that power and not just the Hells Angels, but maybe in the music industry, you know, and, you know, the ride up is great, but you know, you have to realize it may be a ride down.
Yeah, so it's like a drug.
Yeah, don't be an asshole. Yeah, yeah. The come down's tough. You know, it's like I'm, you know, friends with, you know, like John Bernthal, the actor.
Yeah.
He helped me get started in the podcast.
He lives up there, right?
He does, yeah. And a real nice guy.
Yeah.
Very supportive of me. You know, real humble guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's at the top of his game.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
So, gosh, that is a legacy. That is a legacy. Was there anything you regret? You feel like you should have done differently now that you look back as this sagely older gentleman?
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I wish in Los Angeles I'd been a stronger member. I wish I would have absolutely put my foot down on that war with the Mongols. It's a senseless war. It's a needless war.
Yeah.
You know, some people have been killed.
Mm.
You know, but do I have any regrets? No, not really.
Mm.
You know, I mean, so I would have done some things better, you know, but you know what they say, if grandpa or grandma would have had balls, she would have been grandpa.
Yeah.
So, right. So, you know, so, you know, what can I say, you know, with as your tenure as a leader, you get wisdom and you understand things. You know, one of the things that amazes me is the complexity of people's personalities. And I find that you can find something in law enforcement, in Hell's Angels, in the legal department, the guys that work for the city, the guys that work for Southern California Edison. People are basically the same.
Yeah, totally.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, they have different dynamics going for them and whatnot. But basically people are all the same.
You know?
And there's some real evil people out there.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that with the federal government, you know, power just corrupts. And so absolute power will corrupt absolutely. And every time it's really, you know, hearing it's tyranny in a way, what they can do and how they can at least bankrupt you during their railroading.
Well, right? You know, it's very interesting you say that because it was a group of law enforcement personnel sitting around, and law enforcement personnel at this table, they were all drinking beer afterwards. A friend of mine was there, and he told me what happened. And one of the guys was going, well, Christy sure fucking made you guys look like shit, you know. He's back now. He's got a TV show on, Outlaw Chronicles, blah, blah, blah. And the one guy at the table goes, no, man, we destroyed his life for about 10 years, you know, with all the legal stuff. Yeah. We broke him financially, and he, you know, he got way off into it. So, you know, hey, I've been broke before, and I've been on top of the world before.
Right. So when you came home in 87, you had what did you do to rebuild? Now you got all this, like, press and juice within the club.
I was broke because I was putting money into the bill as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, my tattoo shop was more popular than ever. I mean, I made a lot of money at that tattoo shop. And, you know, people laugh. I tell people how much money I make there, and they were just kind of, whoa.
Wow.
But it made a lot of money. Had the bail bonds company, had the concert promotion business. Okay. And I was still promoting concerts. You know, they ruined my concert business. But, you know, Jerry Garcia was still doing stuff for me. He was alive. David Crosby was doing stuff for me. You know, I had the local parties, scenes we were doing. So, I mean, you know, I just get back in there and jump in the game, you know?
Yeah.
Same thing again in 2002. You know, I come home and, you know, you got to start over.
Yeah.
Come home in 2014, you know, I'm completely broke. I got to start over. I've got a marriage that's unraveling.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I've got a child that has autism, you know, who ultimately kind of came out of it. It's almost like a miracle.
Wow.
You know, he's wound up becoming a math genius. You know, it's just incredible.
That's
stuff
cool.
He does.
That's,
yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
He didn't even talk till he was 5, 6 years old. You know, he just,
that's, he's a physicist. Wild.
But so you just, you come back and you don't let it break you. And, you know, it's interesting. I recently was thinking about Tyson fighting this new young kid.
Jake Paul?
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I like Jake Paul, you know. I but Tyson, man, Tyson's been through so much.
I know.
You know, and like for me, every time they did something to me, it just made me stronger and smarter.
Mm.
And I see Tyson going in that ring, and I don't know if Tyson's going to play with him or
Is it just boxing?
I think it's just boxing.
Yeah, it's got to be just boxing. I don't know. I mean, 30 years of age difference really does mean a lot, but he's Iron Mike. He's like
a
juggernaut.
I'll be shocked if he doesn't, you know.
Yeah, I think it'll be closer than people think, but I think he could knock him out. If he catches him, he'll knock him out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every time I went through one of these trials and tribulations, man, I came back stronger. You know,
right.
When I went to Spain, I lived in Spain by myself for like 3 years.
Oh yeah. Explain that.
Well,
what was going on there?
I had done that Outlaw Chronicles, really, History Channel called it their surprise hit. It was really popular.
Yeah.
And got a lot of buzz going. But still, I was a multiple felon that had just come back from prison.
Yeah.
And, I was having a tough go of it, and a movie producer in Spain. I had done a stage play. I wrote a 2-hour stage play with another guy. I'd gone around the country doing this stage play. I didn't make a lot of dough, but I got rave reviews on it. So I had the Outlaw Chronicles hit, the stage play that was a hit. The Exile on Front Street got real high marks.
Yeah.
And then I put out that book Marked. It was a novel, fictional novel. And I got a phone call from a production company in Spain. They said, we want to turn this into an episodic TV show. Will you come to Spain? I put my daughter on them, and they paid all my expenses. Flew over there business class. Yeah. And it was so interesting. I go to England, and they flip out, man.
They know you over there.
Yeah, they just flip out.
You went to the club.
I went to the airport. The immigration flips out.
Holy shit.
My passport's flagged.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And they're flipping out. And, you know, I show them the letter. I've got this letter of introduction. I'm going to Spain to make this TV show. So I get to Spain. It's not, you know, I'm like 6 hours in immigration over in England, you know, fighting my way in to get to Spain. It's, you know, welcome to Spain, Mr. Christie. You know,
stamp. Yeah, exactly. In.
Yeah.
Yeah. In, fast track.
Yeah. I walk out to the lobby and there's my limousine with the guy with the sign Christie. You know, yeah. They take me down to my apartment. It's four floors up. I got the whole floor, fourth floor of this luxury apartment. And
fucking A.
There I lived, you know.
Wow. Well, as you were developing this TV show?
Yeah.
And did it ever
paying for everything.
And it never went to series.
COVID.
Ah, I gotcha. Yeah,
COVID. So I think one of the producers put a lot of dough in his pocket during COVID, and it never just died a slow death.
Yeah.
You know, never got off the ground, like a lot of stuff did.
These projects do.
Yeah. And, you know, Beverly and I was getting letters from Bob, texts every day from Beverly's husband, Bob, and they stopped. And I was like, fuck, he died. Because I knew he had cancer, but he told me he wasn't going to die, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd had dinner with Bob and Beverly before I left for Spain. So I got a hold of Bev, and Bev was really, really depressed and down. And then I think about a year probably passed, maybe a little bit longer, and Bev called me on the phone and was talking about, I'm thinking about coming, you know, things have been really, you know, we're having a communication. Things have been hard. So we start talking. I said, why don't you come to Spain? She goes, really? And then I tell her, I go, yeah, you could stay with me. And she goes, stay with you. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
And that's exactly what she told me. She goes, what does that mean? And I go, exactly what it sounds like. Stay with me. You know, I said, you could. Oh, here we go. Oh, he's actually going to.
This is the last chapter of our lives.
I did say that.
Let's do it together and go out in a blaze of glory.
I mean, who?
It's Outlaw. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's gangster. That's, yeah,
I said, as a tourist guide, you're going to show me around? I says, or at your place. And he goes, no, this is the last chapter of our life.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
You know, and you know,
that's pimp shit.
I mean,
that's quite a line.
There's somebody that's, you've known since you were 12.
Right.
I know I can trust her.
Sure.
She was loyal to Bob.
Yeah.
Bob never had a bad word to say about her for 57 years. That's a long friggin' haul.
I love that. I'm going to use that if that ever.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that ever happens.
Yeah.
If I find myself.
But you got to be at least 70 before you say
for
it.
Sure. For sure. Now, did a lot of bikers, you said all of your friends are gone.
Yeah.
Did bikers die early?
I think so, yeah.
Like, are we talking like cirrhosis of the liver, lung cancer? Because everybody was a smoker.
Bullets. Yeah, smokers.
What's that?
Bullets and knives.
Right, and people get killed.
People getting killed and whatnot. Like I said, I mentioned, you know, when we did the earlier interview, it's like in the 70s was murder, you know. I mean, a lot of murders unsolved are still unsolved.
Yeah.
And
you think that was the most violent era?
And probably Ventura member named Jesse was probably the end of that era.
What
last
happened
guy to
him?
Get murdered, got murdered, you know.
Do we know over what?
Well, suspicion.
What's the suspicion?
He was from Los Angeles. People getting busted. People that knew too much. Maybe I don't know. You know, it was. You know, it's in my book. I go through all these, and I say perhaps Jesse was the last victim of the 70s.
Yeah,
and I write about it, and I write about how he was found. I write about the homicide cop that he told me. You know, it's interesting because you kind of alluded to it earlier, but they were going to close the murder investigation down. And he comes to me and says, I don't know what the hell you got going on down there. He goes, I've never investigated a case. He goes, nobody has one word to say to us.
Mm.
And he said, you know what? Hats off to you, Christy. And he goes, but stay the fuck out of Santa Barbara. He was a Santa Barbara homicide cop. And I said, I was never up there.
Yeah.
He goes, whatever, you know.
Mm.
And you know who instigated that whole investigation? It's in the book. Was the cops come to me. I tell them to go fuck themselves. The cops call Sonny. And Sonny gets in a dialogue with him. And Sonny gets them to engage in conversation. They take the conversation, play it to a judge, and the judge gives them a search warrant, and they come in the Ventura Clubhouse.
Did Sonny do that on purpose?
Some people thought so. I never really thought so. At least I didn't want to think so.
Did he ever rat?
I don't know.
You think so? Beverly's saying yeah. But
there's unanswered questions, but he's not here to defend himself. We don't know that. So
how did things end with you?
Him and I never spoke again.
Okay.
The last time I talked to him, this is a really great story. Calls me on the phone. A book comes out called Angels of Death.
Yeah.
And in the book, they do a chapter on Sonny and do a chapter on me.
Mm.
And in that chapter, they call me the Al Capone of Ventura. That I run the town like Al Capone ran Chicago, blah, blah, blah. And then there's another caption in the book, has a picture of me, and it says, the longest serving president in Hell's Angel history. And Sonny just goes ballistic.
Wigged out, yeah.
Wigged out. He calls me up on the phone, and he goes, you know what? And he's talking with us. You know what? And he said, you've been president too long. And I said, excuse me? And I said, you know what, Ralph, that's none of your business, man. That's Ventura business. And then he goes, and I'll tell you what else. He goes, you're a liar and a cheat. And so I said to him, I go, really? I go, that's what you think? And he goes, yeah. And I go, you want to know what I think? I go, I don't think it matters what you think anymore. And he hung up on me. So I called him back. We're like two little kids. I call him back and I go, hey, Ralph, I go, we got disconnected. And he goes, no, we didn't. And I slammed the phone down.
Nice.
I had to hang up
nice
on
one.
Him.
You got him.
That was the last time we talked.
Oh, man.
And that was probably in 2005.
Uh-huh.
And then I left 5-6 years later.
When did he pass?
He passed 2 years ago.
And he wasn't in prison?
No, he was home.
Okay.
When he passed.
Okay. Yeah. So how much time was he down in his
13
life?
13 years.
Okay. Wow. So people can read. People should go out and get these books because all of this real cool nuance that, I got some of it out of you. But, the stories are endless.
You know, this is part of American history.
Totally.
America has always had a romance with outlaws.
Yep.
And this is just part of that romance, whether you like us, hate us,
right,
or whatever, And, people say, why are you doing this, George? You're giving it all up. I'm not putting anybody in jail. Everybody I'm writing about is pretty much dead.
Of course.
And you know what? I'm creating a historical record. 100 years from now, if somebody has an interest in the outlaw bike movement, they can take what I've written and collected, and they can either read it and immerse themselves in it, or maybe write their own story of how they see it. Because, mine is, I've got to say, it's probably slanted in a sense because it's how I see it and how I felt it and how I lived it. But, I'm probably not as hard on myself as some people would like me to be.
Well, you're definitely an authority on it. So,
well, I think so. Yeah.
I definitely think that it is an important part of American history. And like we were talking about Cavario, I told him, keep putting out this content about his own history,
right,
with, involving black ghettos and the emergence of this really fascinating subculture of black heroin dealers. Not that it's anything to glorify, but
I understand.
It's kind of a fascinating, but it doesn't exist anymore. And so,
but they were controlling the market, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were real criminals.
Yeah. And that was
outlaws, they were criminals.
And that was the first time that they had really kind of taken the power away, right?
Totally. And, and so,
and how did, what was Bumpy Johnson? How did he fit into all that?
Well, he was of an earlier generation when the heroin market was completely
controlled
by the Italians who were getting it from either Southeast Asia or from the French Connection, Sicily. Right, and that we all know about that.
I think a lot of that stuff was coming in up in Canada.
Yeah. Now.
Well,
or back then.
Back then. Even.
Back then, for sure. They're that big port over there.
Yeah.
I think now that's like Chinese fentanyl because they have a huge Chinese diaspora. Right. But the Hell's Angels are super active in BC.
Well, they're connected to the mob up there.
That's right. Yeah. And so they do a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to smuggling those drugs across
the US border. They do a lot of muscle stuff too.
Yeah.
Too, I think.
Yeah.
You know? I know there was a war up there that raged for years with the Rock Machine. And are you familiar with the Rock Machine?
What's that? Who's that?
They created, they were involved in the cocaine business, and they created the Rock Machine. They created this little alliance, and they started wearing patches like they were bikers. And ultimately, they became bandidos.
Oh, okay.
And then I think the Hells Angels kind of sucked them all up.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember we used to go up to BC in like 2006, and we were like, oh, it's legal to smoke weed here. Thought that was like cool back then because it was still
how
illegal.
Did you get in up there with being a felon?
Oh, this is way before felons.
Because
Way before felonies.
Because I can't get up there.
Yeah.
I can't get up there.
Yeah, exactly. They really like, they're strict about it. But yeah, all the little bars and stuff around like the little seedy East Chambers Street, East Vancouver bars and strip clubs. It was all biker controlled. It was all Hell's Angels slinging pot.
Do you ever see their clubhouses up there?
No, I'd love to, though.
Incredible club. Well, the government's taken a lot of them, you know?
Right, yeah.
But really serious guys, you know, it's
super serious.
Yeah, very serious guys up there. And that war was, I think, 14, 15 people were killed, like 95 people wounded.
Yeah.
It was a very serious.
Yeah. So, but Ventura kind of dodged all that massive carnage. I know, I'm not saying people, brothers didn't get killed, but like, you know, you see about these shootouts down in Louisiana or Texas.
We
and
controlled
it's
everything.
Literally like 20 people dead in a bar shootout. Yeah. Like it's the literal
Wild West.
But we
controlled everything there. It was, you know, it was, I mean, we really ruled it. We really ruled it with
it. They used him.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when they brought, when I was trying to end that conflict in Sweden and Denmark and all those Nordic countries, they brought Blondie over, who was a murderer, convicted murderer, Hell's Angel, and they brought, I think it was Tom, his name escapes me right now. Jim from the leader of the Bandidos, they brought both those guys over on special visas. The Scandinavian government petitioned the American government and said, look, Christie's trying to end this war with these guys. We want you to allow them to come in. George Weggers and George Christie, leaders from the Hells Angels and Bandidos, are going to broker a meeting, and they're going to sponsor the meeting in Spokane, Washington. We have a special number for you to call. If anybody interferes, to call this number and they'll tell them to stand down. Yeah. Any law enforcement personnel.
So they brokered that. Yeah. The government made that happen.
The Scandinavian government petitioned the American government. The American government granted them. We had the number that if anybody was to interfere in law enforcement, they would be told to stand down. Right. We talked to them.
So you called them from Spokane, Washington?
No. We didn't.
Oh, you went over there?
No, they came here.
Okay, I thought you said.
I did go over there a couple of times.
Okay, I didn't know. I thought you were just on the phone and they brought the other guys over. Okay, so you actually, they brought you over there.
It was all face-to-face. And
oh, I see. Yeah. Where did you guys meet?
We met in Spokane, Washington.
I got you. So that was the neutral. Okay, got it.
I think it was the Waffle House. No, I'm always joking because everything happens at the Waffle House.
Wow, that is so crazy. Yeah. That.
And then they went back.
Wow.
Then they went back and announced with the politicians that there was now a peace between the Bandidos and the Hells Angels. They made a big public event out of it.
Unbelievable. You'll never see that today.
Yeah. No.
You never see that today because governments don't want to give the perception that criminals or outlaws have any say in anything.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now they don't even like to put their names in the papers.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah. They don't even like to say, you know, the Bandidos and the Hells Angels.
Because they don't want to give them any more press.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. God, that is fascinating.
Are we done, man?
We're done, man.
Okay,
go.
I'm pretty tired.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is a perfect way to end things. George Christie, thank you again. Go get his books, georgechristie.com or on Amazon. He's got 4 of them, right?
3, and I've got 1 coming.
Got it. So go grab the 3. Fascinating, and really appreciate you. And yeah, let's look out for that YouTube channel.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, man.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Patreon. Bye-bye.
Bye.